You're listening to the Historical Bookworm Show for lovers of history and readers of inspirational fiction. Join your hosts, Kylie and Darcy, for author interviews, a pinch of the past, and special bookworm reviews.
Hi, this is Kylie Woodley.
And Darcy Fournier.
Our guest today is the best-selling author of more than 40 books and a variety of novellas. Her books have been honored with a starred review from Publishers Weekly and have been finalists for the ACFW Carol Award, the Holt Medallion, and the Bookseller's Best. Amanda Cabot, welcome to the Historical Bookworm Show.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Kylie.
So I wanted to start with a quote by C.S. Lewis. And he says this when he comes to the end of an experiment in criticism. He writes, "In reading great literature, I become a thousand men and yet remain myself. Like the night sky in the Greek poem, I see with a myriad of eyes, but it is still I who see. Here, as in worship, in love, in moral action, and in knowing, I transcend myself and am never more myself than when I do." I think this is just a really incredible reflection on the way that we can see the world through our characters' eyes in that story world and what we learn. And then as a writer, Amanda, getting to build that story world, books are powerful, story is so powerful. So when you were younger, was there any, maybe a favorite book or character that you really enjoyed or connected with?
Well, one of the questions you had asked me was about actors and actresses. Who was a favorite? And my favorite actress from way back when was Audrey Hepburn. I loved her for so many reasons. And she was a wonderful actress. And she did so many different kinds of roles. If I had to pick a favorite movie of hers, it would be Charade, which again is a real oldie. But what I liked about that was, although it's a suspense movie in many respects, they keep killing people and you're trying to figure out why and who's the bad guy, there are also wonderful moments of humor that deflect from the suspense. And then the combination of the two, I think, makes it a very powerful movie. So one of the things that I try to do when I write is, even though I write about serious subjects, and I do have what I call suspense in my books, I also try to have moments of humor, because I think we all need that as a balancing act. You can't have constant suspense, and for me, constant humor is too much. But putting the two of them together seems to work really well. At least it appeals to me.
Yes, and in that way, you're able to really address some of the harder issues that your characters may be going through. And as a reader, I would feel like, oh, now I have a break. I can kind of laugh with this character. An entire novel constantly addressing serious things and maybe just full of suspense can be tiring as a reader. So I can definitely understand that. And Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn were so adorable in Charade. Cary Grant is one of my favorite oldies, and he is just hilarious.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
So what drew you to historical fiction?
I wish I could give you an answer. All I can tell you is that for as long as I can remember, although I've read all kinds of stories and had all kinds of stories read to me, even as a young child, my favorites were the ones that started once upon a time and ended, and they all lived happily ever after. So having heard that, it's not a surprise that I write historical romances.
Yes, definitely. I won't read a book without happily ever after. And there's just something special about historical fiction in general, just like looking back at the way things were and how people were different, but also still we can connect with them because of the similarities.
Exactly. Historical fiction lets you experience a different time, lets you see a different lifestyle. In some respects, if it's done well, it teaches you some things, because a person who's skilled at writing historical fiction tosses in a few little tidbits that make the world come to life. Yesterday, I learned from someone that I was talking to that before there was air conditioning in Arizona, I mean, can you imagine being there 110 degrees? How did you live in a house? Well, they had adobe houses, which of course have thick walls, but apparently they at night would spray water on the exterior of the houses, and that brought enough humidity in that it lowered the temperature in the inside of the house enough that you could sleep. Well, I didn't know that, but boy, I keep thinking I should write a book set someplace where there are adobe houses so I could use this fascinating fact. But it's things like that that I think add to the appeal of historical fiction.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the challenges involved with being true to a particular time period when you are a historical author?
You know, you would think that it would be knowing what the historical facts are and working those in, but I find it's actually different things. One, and this one to me is absolutely critical, is using vocabulary that was in use at that particular time. My dictionary, which has the date of first use, is falling apart because I use it so much. As I'm writing, if I have a word that I'm not quite sure, I check it to see, is this a word that was in common usage in 1856, 1880, whatever year I'm writing about? Yesterday, for example, I had a scene where the absolute perfect word for the heroine to have in her thoughts was catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
Something that happened was a catalyst for all of these other things that were happening to her. But I said, I wonder about that. Well, sure enough, I checked. Catalyst is early 20th century. I couldn't use it. I had to find another word. To me, using that vocabulary and staying within the time period is really important. The other challenge is understanding the social customs of the time. For example, there was more formality. You didn't just automatically call someone by their first name. You had to be asked to do that. And it was extremely rare to ever address someone from an older generation by their first name.
Mm-hmm.
And I get annoyed when I read books where people are calling others by, they call their minister, oh, hi, John. I don't think so. I mean, in that era, it would be, hello, Pastor Jacobs. And you would never have called him, especially if he was your father's age, by his first name. It's knowing things like that that give authenticity to a book and make readers feel like they really are back in the time period.
Yeah, and really something to connect with, because as a reader, if those kind of things are important to you, historical detail being accurate, then you want to see that. And readers, they will catch. Readers are smart, especially readers of historical fiction. Like they have done their research. And a lot of times if there's some inaccuracy, like they'll catch it. It's funny too, you mentioned using sir in titles and whatnot. And I think that applies geographically as well. I lived in Texas for a number of years and everything was yes, sir, yes, ma'am. Even working in the schools down there with the young people in elementary, I saw teachers also referring to a young man who's 6, 7 years old as sir. You know, it's a matter of just a propriety. So it can be interesting too how different geographical areas have different social etiquettes that they abide by. And capturing that in historical fiction can be a lot of fun, but I think it'll probably be a bit of work as well.
At times it's a challenge, but we owe it to our readers to give them the very best experience possible. And when someone picks up a book of historical fiction, they want to be immersed in that time period. They don't want there to be something that draws them out of it, like having someone in a 19th century book say, well, compliment just float off her like Teflon.
Yeah.
Things like that are just, I mean, that's blatant, but there are other times when you'll see something that is just so wrong, and I, as a reader, stop reading at that point because the author has lost all credibility with me.
Mm-hmm. And a reader's time is important, so.
It is.
We want that escape, and we want it to be accurate and authentic.
Very true.
So is there anything especially interesting that you maybe haven't covered in other interviews that you could share with us? Or perhaps there's something that God has laid on your heart that you would like to share with your readers?
Well, this isn't really new, but it's an important thing. It's an important aspect of me, which is that readers are the reason that I write. Some people say, do you write for yourself? And no, I don't. And yes, I enjoy the stories and creating the characters, but I am writing because my goal is to touch readers' hearts and to deepen their faith. And I do that by writing fiction, historical fiction to be specific.
That's wonderful. I run across a couple authors in the Christian book market who do really consider their writing to be a ministry to their readers. And I think when you look at ministry, there's a lot of work that goes in that. If you're fulfilling your calling and just following God, what a weight that can be lifted because you're doing what you're supposed to be doing and following God in that way. So that's really, I'm so glad that's how you feel about your writing. That's wonderful. So now let's take a moment to talk about your latest release, The Spark of Love. And I pulled up the back cover copy and to read it now, just in case some of our listeners are not familiar with this title. When the spurned suitor threatens her, heiress Alexandra Tarkington flees New York for Mesquite Springs in the Texas Hill Country, where her father is building a hotel. But the happy reunion she envisioned is not to be, as her father insists she return to New York. Instead, Alexandra carves out a niche of her own in town, teaching school children to paint and enjoying the company of Gabe Seymour, a delightful man she met on the stagecoach. But all is not as it seems. Two men, each with his own agenda, have followed her to Mesquite Springs, and Gabe is an investigator, searching for proof that her father is a swindler. With so much to lose and hide from one another, Alexandra and Gabe will have to come together if they are ever to discover whether the spark they felt from the beginning can kindle the fire of true love. So we have what sounds like a sweet read with a twist of danger and an intelligent hero, and it's set in Texas. And my husband's from Texas, and I lived there for a couple of years, so I absolutely love this setting. And what is your connection, Amanda, to Texas as a setting for your book and just the books of the series?
The majority of my books are set in Texas, and there's a very good reason for that. My early childhood was spent in a small town in Texas, not in the Hill Country, but in eastern Texas. I was there from the time I was about a year and a half until I was seven. So my earliest memories are of small town life in Texas. Now, I spent the rest of my life in the Northeast, and now I live in Wyoming, but those early memories are very vivid, and they led me to want to use Texas as a setting and also to recreate the small town experience.
And what would you say sets this book apart from the previous books, Out of the Embers and Dreams Rekindle?
Well, although it is set in the same town, and we do have some continuing characters, there are several differences. First of all, my two main characters are both newcomers to the town. In the previous books, we had residents of the town as one of the characters. So we have that. Also, for the first time ever, I have a book with two villains. I'm not sure I'd do it again, but it was an interesting experience creating them. That added complexity to the story. Also, because it's the last book in the series, it gives me an opportunity to wrap up some things. And I have characters from the previous books who play roles, admittedly secondary roles here. But I was able to take a character who readers meet in book one, who needed redemption, and I give him redemption in book three. And I also have another character who has been disappointed in love in books one and two. And she really needed her happily ever after. So I got to add that to book three as well. As you can tell, there's a lot of stuff going on in The Spark of Love.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like it. And I always love when the details and characters from previous books are interwoven into that final book. I read everything in series. I love series because I feel like I can have that wonderful love story and then get a little taste maybe in the next book, or sort of like a check-in of how the first, you know, original couple was doing. So it's so neat that you were able to do that really in the third book and bring in that redeeming factor for that one individual as well.
It was fun, but as I said, there were challenges having so many things going on. And of course, I have a word count restriction, and I'm always pushing the upper limits on that because I do write long, complex stories.
And you said you write for your readers. So what overarching themes would you say minister to the readers of The Spark of Love?
Actually, not just in The Spark of Love, but in all of my books, if there were a single theme, and I think there is to all of them, it's the healing power of love, the love between a man and a woman, and God's love for us.
Wow. Yeah. So part of the reason I love Christian romance, because when I read it as a Christian woman, wife, mother, I can learn things and be like, hey, I need to work on this, or it just really helps to build my faith, I think, and also encourage me in my walk with God and my relationship with my spouse. So is there one scene that you can share without giving away any spoilers that was maybe your favorite to write?
Yeah, and actually, I'm not doing a spoiler because this is in an excerpt. It's part of the first chapter, and the excerpt of that is on my website. So if people want to read the whole thing, it is the introduction to one of my two villains. The scene starts with someone saying to him, how would you like to be a rich man? And it ends with, Sonny's surprise increased, and he started to laugh. He'd done many things for the old man, but never that. It was fun to write because it was introducing this character who isn't necessarily someone you want as a good friend, but I loved being able to do the introduction, and I'm hoping that last line, which happens to be one of my favorites from the whole book, is enough to intrigue readers, that they will keep reading to find out what is it that the old man asked Sonny to do, and why was he laughing?
Yeah, you definitely intrigued me. And for our listeners, I will include that link in the show notes for anyone who wants to go and read the opening scene for The Spark of Love. Now, Amanda, what is next on your list of to-dos?
Well, the Mesquite Springs trilogy is finished, but I am hard at work on a new trilogy. In fact, I'm working on the second book in this. It's been titled The Secrets of Sweetwater Crossing. Sweetwater Crossing is another one of my fictional towns in the Hill Country. The first book, After the Shadows, will be available March of next year. The second one, which is Against the Wind, is tentatively scheduled to come out in October of next year. And then the final book, Into the Starlight, has a July of 2024 release date. So I'm finished. The first book has been through the first round of editing, and I am working on the first of my two drafts for the second book. It's keeping me busy.
I can imagine so. It's really neat that you have the next couple of years planned out as well. So cannot wait to see those books and hopefully talk to you again. Thank you for coming on the show. Amanda has been so generous in offering a book as a giveaway. So we will have the links to that on our website, historicalbookworm.com. And Amanda, where can our listeners learn more about you?
My website has basically everything on it. I call it the one-stop shopping, and it is www.amandacabot.com. It has information about all of my books, including excerpts from each of them. It has information about me. For prospective writers, there is a section on hints for writers, blog posts that I've done that may help writers along the way. There's an FAQ if you've got questions. For people who are looking for speakers, workshop presenters, I've got a tab that includes that.
Now for a pinch of the past.
If you're anything like me, about this time of year, you start looking forward to the warmth and life of springtime. So I thought it would be fun to look at a few legends from ancient peoples of how the seasons came to be.
Oh, interesting. I always love finding out how our holidays often coincide with the way that people from a long time ago observed the seasons.
Yes, and I actually ran into one of those that I had not heard of before, so we'll get into that in a minute. Our first is a legend from the Polynesian peoples, including the Maoris of New Zealand and the natives of Hawaii. It's about how Maui snares the sun. Now, the Samoans have a similar legend, but a different character than Maui is the hero of their tale.
Very cool. The most I know about Maui is from Moana, the kids' film, so I would love to hear this.
Well, in his song, where he's talking about all the different things he's done, how he held up the sky, how he's lassoed the sun, they are referring to the actual myths. The story goes that the sun rose every morning and would race across the sky so fast that he would scorch humans for a moment, but he didn't linger long enough for people to get any of their work done there. I think there's a reference to there wasn't even time to say a prayer to the gods. There was no time to do anything in the light. So a goddess named Hina couldn't even get her plant pulp to dry properly to make clothing out of. So Maui is her son, and he sees this and he sees how people, you know, need more sunlight and can't get it. And so he decides that he's going to force the sun to slow down in his daily journeys through the sky.
Isn't that like a son? My son says he boasts that he's going to invent, a dishwasher that does everything because he has to rinse, you know, for me.
Oh, yes. So,
yeah. And when he was little, he said that he would invent a diaper changer for me and then he could use it when he got older and had his own kids. So very helpful sons. I understand where Maui's coming from.
Yes, exactly. They have big ideas. It's a good thing. So the legends differ on the details, but most agree that Maui armed himself with several strong ropes and he climbed to the top of the mountain where the sun always passed the closest by. So he lay in wait one night, and when the sun came by, he snared his legs one by one. Some of the legends say that as he snared the sun's legs, they broke off. So he got all his strongest legs. And so he's left with only his weak legs. And some legends say that he just roped his legs. So he can't move, can't go anywhere. And then Maui is said to have beaten the sun with a magic stone and threatened to kill him.
Oh my.
Because he's running too fast. And so all he does is blazingly scorch people for a short amount of time. But of course, the sun promised that he will slow his pace for half the days of the year, bringing us summertime with its long days.
Oh, okay.
And then the rest of the days, he's allowed to race on by.
Oh, that's cute.
And they say that the references in the legends are to days that are so short that they could only be occurring near the Arctic poles.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be evidence of, people groups migrating or something like that, because they're referring to such short, short days in this legend that in Hawaii, in New Zealand, and the other Polynesian islands, they never, ever have experienced days that short.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it could just be, legend exaggeration too. You never know.
Oh, very cool.
Yes. So the second legend is from Gaelic and Celtic cultures. Ireland and Scotland especially have an overlapping legend about the goddess Cailleach, the queen of winter. And her rule over the land officially began on Samhain, which is basically coincides with Halloween every year. In Scotland, on the west coast, she was said to take 3 days washing her tartan, or her blanket, in the sea every autumn. And you could just hear the ocean roaring for 3 days while she's washing her coat.
Aww.
After which it turned pure white and spread over the land as snow.
So a winter blizzard or storm.
Exactly. Yes. So Cailleach carries a staff with freezing powers. So it can, when it strikes, it can turn things to ice.
Mm-hmm.
She's credited with making certain mountains in Scotland and Ireland, kind of sculpting the landscape of the ground. But apparently, she has to keep herself warm during the winter, which is odd for a queen of winter. But they say that she will wake on February 1st to gather more firewood if it's going to be a long winter, because she needs to store up more to keep herself warm while she continues to extend winter of the land. But if she just sleeps through the day on February 1st and doesn't gather any more wood, winter won't last much longer and spring will come.
Huh. Does that coincide with Groundhog's Day?
That's what I'm thinking, because Groundhog Day is February 2nd, but, you know, it's like if it's a stormy day so the groundhog can't see a shadow, then that would go back to this goddess asleep, you know, so she's not going to get enough firewood and so spring has to come sooner.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I had no clue. I had always wondered where Groundhog Day came from, but mm-hmm. It looks like it could trace some of its roots to here.
Very neat.
And our last one is the one that's probably most familiar to those of us in the West. Coming from the ancient Greeks, we have the myth of Demeter and Persephone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you remember this one from school. Demeter was the goddess of fruitfulness and harvest, who made the sun shine, gentle rains fall, and food grow. And her daughter Persephone was her dearest treasure. They went everywhere together. But one day, Persephone went off a little ways and was making a flower crown while her mother was busy, and Hades, the ruler of the underworld, went for a chariot ride on the earth. He saw Persephone, fell in love with her at once, and kidnapped her, because that's what you do when you fall in love with people.
You do when you're Greek.
Okay, at least in the ancient stuff.
I'm sorry. That's what happens.
Yes, you do when you are a Greek god. There, that's exactly yes, right.
When you're a Greek mythical god.
Right. So all that was left was a little flower crown. And so for weeks, Demeter searched for her daughter, and she neglected her duties until the humans were crying out to Zeus, the chief god, because their crops were failing. So it was Zeus who eventually located Persephone. And at first, Demeter was hopeless because her daughter had been taken to the underworld. But Zeus said if Persephone had eaten no food in the underworld, she might return to the earth. So meanwhile, Hades is treating Persephone as kindly as he can. He's seeking to marry her, but she is refusing to eat and just languishing away in the dark underworld. She's never been anywhere away from the sky and the sun. So one day, Hades brings her a fresh pomegranate and entreats her to eat something. And so she's so soft-hearted that she finally takes pity on him and eats 6 of the little pomegranate seeds. So when this was discovered, Zeus made a compromise that for each seed she had eaten, Persephone must remain with Hades 1 month every year. For the other 6 months, she could return to her mother. Thus, during summer, the world is fruitful for Demeter because she is joyfully fulfilling her duties. And then in winter, the world is barren because she's mourning her daughter's absence.
Oh my goodness. I'm sorry, but that's just sad.
Honestly, it is. I mean, it is sad. It is sad. But the Greeks did love their tragedies.
Yes, they did, didn't they? I read once in university that the Judeo-Christian God was the first God where people realized, like, the idea of a God as a savior and loving and there for you, like a father, as opposed to a very sort of vengeful, terrifying God, the way that the different people groups had, like, Baal and Zeus and different, you know, Egyptian gods, and they were all fierce and terrifying, and, you know, they wanted your children sacrificed for some reason and whatnot. But like the Judeo-Christian God, the real God, was the first in recorded history, like speaking in the ancient world, that offered love and life.
Exactly. And I mean, you look at the Greek gods, and they were just very selfish, honestly. My dad describes them as like teenagers with superpowers.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there, Demeter loses her daughter, and well, suddenly the whole world's going to starve to death, you know, because she can't fulfill her duties, you know. So, but the true God is unselfish, and he's so big that it's not like anything's going to be difficult for him or impossible for him.
Yes.
So with all these legends, I did want to close with a look at the Bible's remarks on the seasons. Mm-hmm. After the flood in Genesis 8, when Noah and his family left the ark and offered sacrifices to God, he promised, "I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease."
Time for our bookworm review. Counterfeit Love by Crystal Caudill. Can this undercover agent save the woman he loves, or is her heart as counterfeit as the money he's been sent to track down? After all that grandfather has sacrificed to raise her, Teresa Plain owes it to him to save the family name. And that means clearing their debts with creditors before she marries Edward Greystone. But when one of the creditors' threats leads her to stumble across a midnight meeting, she discovers that the money he owes isn't all grandfather was hiding. And the secrets he kept have now trapped Teresa in a life-threatening fight for her home and the truth. After months of undercover work, Secret Service operative Broderick Cosgrove is finally able to uncover the identity of the leader of a notorious counterfeiting ring. That moment of triumph turns to horror, however, when he finds undeniable proof that his former fiancée is connected. Can he really believe the woman he loved is a willing participant? Protecting Teresa and proving her innocence may destroy his career, but that's better than failing her twice in one lifetime. They must form a partnership, tentative though it is. But there's no question they're both still keeping secrets, and that lack of trust, along with the dangerous criminals out for their blood, threatens their hearts, their faith, and their very survival.
Today's Bookworm Review is brought to you by Kylie Woodley. What a splendid novel. The Secret Service element and investigation into a counterfeiting ring makes for a unique read. And the romance? What fun. Crystal brings Teresa Plain to life with her queen likes, regal stature, and brave heart. Teresa and Broderick Cosgrove are childhood sweethearts, now grown and on very different paths of life. After a 6-year separation, they are thrust into the investigation of a counterfeiting ring in which Teresa is unwittingly involved. Amid love and grief, Teresa faces many trials and learns to trust the friends God has placed around her. This book contains some violent scenes. However, they're not explicitly gruesome. Romance is clean, contained to kisses and fond thoughts and memories. There are some scenes that take place in saloons and a brothel as the characters go undercover. And while this may offend those of a sensitive nature, they were not so explicit as to warrant a PG-13 rating. If you're looking for a book that takes you to the snowy streets of 1800s Cincinnati and the dangers of running from criminals, if you love stories of forbidden romance and themes of forgiveness and grace, you won't want to pass over Counterfeit Love by Crystal Caudill, available on ebook, paperback, and audio.
You've been listening to the Historical Bookworm Show, where history meets fiction. For more information, find us at historicalbookworm.com.